The very first thing we would do is just pluck the C string, the G string, and then sing something simple like...
Everybody should know how to make a little music, right? I'm Gabriel Spitzer, it's Sound Effect from KPLU, and this is me attempting to learn the ukulele.
But I'm going to show you a chord.
Okay.
Your fingers are 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
The frets are 1, 2, 3. Mm-hmm. There's very few rules on the ukulele, but you want to try to put your third finger on the third fret there.
Okay.
That is Susan Howell, who's also known as Sukulele. And she is a ukulele evangelist. And I have to say, she's a very patient teacher, even with my chubby fingers.
Okay. That's a C chord. Much easier than the guitar. Ready for another chord?
I'm not sure. I'm good here.
A ukulele does feel a little bit like a toy when you first pick one up. But following along with Sukulele, you can't help but start to appreciate its depth and its texture. And if you didn't before, even a very short lesson will make you take the ukulele seriously.
There, yeah.
Got it. All right.
Now what we're going to do is we're going to switch from that to that first finger. Yay! That's a C7th chord.
A C7th, of course. That's a nice tone.
And now you would... You would...
Well, today on the show, we are going to spin a few of our favorite stories about music and music makers, from a band of well-known Seattle authors to the Hawaiian songwriter inspired by Seattle's rain. Stories of making a joyful noise, coming up right here on Sound Effect from KPLU.
Okay, ready to do it?
No, can we go over that one more time?
Yes. Go get a ukulele of your own.
If you need a testament to how powerful playing music can be, look no further than Ruby Bishop. She's at a place of her life where not much feels good. She's got a lot of aches, a lot of pains, and yet she is perfectly at ease behind a piano, whether that's at home or in the darkened corner of an old Italian restaurant. KPLU's Ed Ronco introduced us.
At about 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, Ruby Bishop walks in the door at Vito's, an Italian restaurant on Seattle's First Hill. Every Sunday, she plays jazz standards here at a Baby Grand in the lounge. She takes off her coat and tosses it behind the piano as a group of regulars walk in. They take a table right in front.
Hello, how goes it?
Hi. Pretty good. Not too hot.
She's played piano all her life. Her career has introduced her to some of the jazz world's greatest names.
I heard some stories that you knew Louis Armstrong.
Louis and I were good friends. And he'd come to my house, and I'd ask the guys in his band what they wanted to eat for dinner, and I'd cook a meal for them. They didn't get much good food when they were on the road.
I talked to Ruby in a couple of places, first at Vito's, and then at her home. I missed her a few times because she was getting over an illness, and that's a bigger deal for her than it might be for you or me.
What's that I hear working around me?
Because Ruby Bishop is 95 years old.
Ooh, your feet's too big. Ooh, where'd you get those feet?
You have to picture this. It's really dark in here. There are candles flickering on each table. Ruby is sitting at the piano, which is kind of in a corner, underneath a disco ball, against two walls with floor-to-ceiling mirrors. She takes requests, she offers a quick thank you to anyone who puts a tip in the glass, and then one of those regulars sitting at the table in front gets up, sits down next to her, and starts to sing. She doesn't mind the company, and she didn't mind the company when I dropped by her house a few days later.
Hello, Ruby. Thanks for having me over.
Oh, glad I could.
How are you?
Oh, I'm better. I think I feel better today than I have in a couple of days.
Good.
The walls of Ruby's living room have pictures of her from throughout the years hanging up. In one of them, she's young, with a beehive hairdo and a delicate necklace. Today, when she plays a gig, she's usually wearing a gray wig and a large string of pearls. As you might expect, there's a baby grand piano in this room, and on the music stand is a black and white photo of a man.
This is my husband after me. This was him first, when I first met him. Wasn't he handsome when he was young?
Yes.
That's the way he was when I met him.
Uniform's a nice look for him.
Yeah.
She taps on the photo, and she says they had some great times together. But when I ask her about some of those times, she goes to get a tissue from the bathroom.
When I get into talking about him and all that, I just kind of fall apart, you know?
Back at the piano, Ruby Bishop gathers herself.
Come alive when you're behind a piano. You're alive all the time, but you there's something special. Your face changes, and I'm wondering if you can describe how it feels to be behind a piano, to play a piano.
I never thought about it, you know. I don't do it for that. I just go ahead and do what I feel like.
Do you remember the first whole song you learned how to play on the piano?
I can't remember anything anymore. You know, I'm lucky to be alive. I am so lucky to be alive.
As we're sitting there, I ask her about some of her memories, but her voice trails off a little bit. Names, dates, those are sometimes a struggle. And when she struggles, she turns back to the baby grand and runs her purple fingernails up the keys.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about this piano here.
Well, I just went to store and bought it.
How long have you had it?
Oh, God, years and years and years. I got three of them, a couple downstairs, and I think they're still down there. I don't know. I haven't been downstairs lately.
When Ruby's at the piano, she's never at a loss for something to say or something to do. So I ask her if the piano gives her strength.
Sometimes, yes. Yes, yes. Yesterday it was. I just came in here and sat down and started playing some things that just made me feel good.
It looks effortless to somebody who doesn't know any better.
Oh, that's good. Oh, yeah. That's a good way of putting it, too, because it's true.
Ruby was born in 1919. She grew up in Rochester and Centralia. She studied to be a beautician, a court reporter. She was a Boeing mechanic during World War II, and she made cabinets for a time. She's played for the troops in South Korea, in Vietnam, and she's performed in Europe and across the United States.
At all.
But now the only place to catch her is Sunday at Vito's.
I'm just wowed by this lady. Like, I just can't believe it. And her fingers are just like, it's like magic.
Kit Tierney is sitting next to me at the bar. She's visiting from out of town.
No, I was just at the hospital because my friend is having cancer surgery, and I walked down to have a beer, and then I saw her, and it's like, wow, you know?
I watch her as she watches Ruby and then scans the room.
You know, look how happy she's making these old people.
These young people.
Well, yeah, and me too. I mean, like middle-aged people, I guess. But you know, the playing is beautiful, and they're hearing all their favorite songs, some of my favorite songs, and it's just wonderful.
Like every week, some people are listening attentively as they sip Chianti. Others are nodding, tapping their feet as they concentrate on plates of pasta or bruschetta. Some, like Kit, are deeply enamored with what they're witnessing. Others have no idea who's sitting at that piano. Ruby is here for all of them. She plays because she loves it. And because when she's behind those keys, she's right at home.
That story from KPLU's Ed Ronco. Just ahead, it's a crazy public radio trifecta. We've got literature, computer science, and jazz. It's ahead on KPLU's Sound Effect. Don't go away.
What's that, John?
Great. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We've been given a listen to our favorite Sound Effect musical performances this week. And for our next performance, we have a very unique band that joined us in our studio with this very melodic take on failure. And they are appropriately named The Rejections.
It never quite sounds right to me.
Yes, it's actually directly from the romantic version of it.
I do, yes, they're totally crazy.
Okay.
These guys are unique for a couple of reasons, but chief among them, they are made up of some of Seattle's best-known authors, as well as some of their trailing spouses.
Okay. I'm Garth Stein. I play the electric bass, and I am an author of The Art of Racing in the Rain, as well as my latest book, A Sudden Light.
Matt Gurney, guitar number two, and trailing spouse of Jenny Shortridge, author.
Ben Bauermeister on fiddle, the trailing spouse of Erica Bauermeister.
I'm Paul Mars. I am the spouse of Laurie Frankel, the author, and I play guitar number one.
I am Stephanie Stevie Kalis. I'm the author of Broken For You, Sing Them Home, and Forthcoming, Language Arts, and I play piano and sing a little.
And I'm Jenny Shortridge. I'm an author
of Love, Water, Memory most recently, and I am the vocalist.
So Jenny Shortridge and Garth Stein, let me ask you a couple of quick questions about how you guys got together and everything. How do you guys know each other?
It all started in a coffee shop.
It started after a really botched reading that we, yeah, and Jenny and I did.
Where, ooh, a failure. It started after,
yes,
a failure?
Oh, absolutely. There was literally only Trailing Spouses in the house, and it was a very big house. But, and so Jenny and I said, hey, let's get together for a cup of coffee and we can cry together. And that started the whole thing, right?
It did.
So where did the name of the band come from?
Honestly, we kind of modeled it on Stephen King's band, the Rock Bottom Remainders. You know, they had that band for a long time. And so every writer knows rejection. And so to have a band of authors, it just seemed natural to be rejections.
Tell me even more explicitly, when you say you know rejection, what does that mean to you?
I think that authors are actually more the only artistic discipline where the authors are actually more insecure than actors. we sit in a room by ourselves for years. Poor hygiene. We just stare at a computer, don't really talk to people very much. We lose track of social skills. And then after a few years, we say, hey, look, I've got a stack of pages. Please love me. And then we are forced out into public.
It's just an occupational hazard, I think, for writers and for most creative types. And, you know, one of the hardest things is that now with Amazon and Goodreads, authors can go online and read zillions of reviews whereby they might not like your book very much. And so that's it gets harder and harder all the time with audience participation reviewing. And so you have to choose to either turn it off or to blow it off, or I don't know, what do you do, Garth?
With my last book, I was writing this for 2.5 years. I was writing this history of this timber family. And after 2.5 years, I had 100,000 words. And I said, this is great. This is my novel. And I sent it in, and my editor said, what on earth are you thinking? This is totally not your novel. And it took me a while to recover from that. And I had to really dig deep and understand that what I had been doing for 2.5 years is doing research for my novel. And so I was writing the history of this family, which then I set aside entirely and then wrote the book. But if I had set out in the beginning and said, oh, for 2.5 years, I'm going to do some character sketches, I never would have done it. I would have said, that's crazy. I'm going to go do something else for a living or something. So sometimes you do have to have that moment of rejection just to get the clarity of your own vision and to clarify what you're trying to say so that you can then, you know, hone your message.
So what do you guys get out of the music?
You know, there's something that happens when people all sing together. We tend to do a lot of harmonies because when you all sing together and all the instruments and the strings are vibrating together, it is a feeling that you can't get any other way, I don't think.
Interestingly, even our very quiet Trailing Spouses tend to work in solitary environments as well. So it's a little bit of a way to get out of the closet and out into, you know, a social situation that's supportive and we can look forward to every week.
So could you guys take us out with something? You got a little something you can send us on our way with?
We'd love to. This is called Men of Luggage, and it's written by Paul Mars, one of our Trailing Spouses.
Check your coat, sit down and stay a while. Loosen your ties and off the rope to hang yourselves. He's waiting on the nightstand when you're picking up the phone. I thought at least you would have figured out by now that same mistake that you'll make over and don't bury in the past, just digging up the graves. Don't feel bad, I know you'd fight it if you could. Making up the rivals who are knocking down your door. Don't hang around, they might be coming back for blood. That same mistake that you'll make over and over again.
That same
heartbreak that you'll make over and over again. So travel light. So travel light. And you're wearing the coat that isn't keeping out the cold. You carry that torch for yourself. And I warn you, the flame might just burn you at the touch. But you don't want to hear about it all that much. So travel light. Try to retrace your steps. I do not think they'll be coming back for you. Men of luggage, it's okay. It's hard to live this life in your shoes. I don't know what I would do. That same mistake that you'll make over and over again. That same heartbreak that you'll make over and over again. So travel light. So travel light. That same mistake that you'll make over and over again. So that same heartbreak that you'll make over and over again.
Well, I want to thank Jenny Shortridge, Matt Ghani, Paul Maris, Stevie Kalis, Ben Bauermeister, and Garth Stein. They make up The Rejections. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here, and today we are playing some hits, giving a second spin to some of our favorite musical performances from the past year. The sax player you're hearing right now is Anton Schwartz, and he's a widely respected jazz musician, and he recorded this song just for us in the KPLU studios. Schwartz splits his time between Seattle and San Francisco these days. He's taught music at Stanford Jazz Workshop. He's been an artist in residence at Harvard. But before he was a full-time saxophone player, he was on a very different career path. He spoke with Sound Effect's Kevin Kenisted.
When I was in college, I was interested in math and computer science and philosophy and psychology. And I went on to artificial intelligence, which is under the rubric of computer science.
I think a lot of people probably have a different idea or have their own idea of what artificial intelligence and the work in artificial intelligence actually is. So can you explain what you were doing?
I was interested in an area called machine learning, which is, as you might imagine, getting machines to learn, getting them to arrive at behaviors, ability to give answers to questions, ability to perhaps navigate in an environment when they haven't been taught how to do it. So I was interested in getting computers to learn more the way babies do, know, when they're just kind of fumbling around and they start to develop concepts and then build bigger concepts on littler concepts and build wrong concepts and then have to update them. And
So you had this, it sounded like, were you passionate about artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I was, it was a great thing. I was on an NSF scholarship. I was an NSF fellow. I was on a National Science Foundation fellowship. They were giving me free rein to do whatever I wanted, the coolest thing I could think of.
And what were you doing?
I was working on machine learning, doing research, inspired by my notions of what it's like to be in the world, which happened to be very different from the direction that most of artificial intelligence was going in at the time. It was pretty idyllic, really.
You changed to a musician. You became a musician. That seems like a pretty radical change to go from the artificial intelligence field to the jazz world. Was there a moment where you said, this needs to happen?
It happened. It took me by surprise. I decided that even though it was amazingly cool to be thinking about these things that I was thinking about and working on the things I was working on, I just wasn't really happy with that life. For me, it was a life of more isolation than I wanted. And I was a good mathematician, but I wasn't a brilliant mathematician. And I was an undergrad at Harvard where the math majors were, you know, just scary people, the kind who, you know, become professors at 18, 19 sometimes. Those people show up. If I had had that kind of ability, you know, that's the point at which it becomes like an art. But I wasn't born an engineer, right? That wasn't in me. So I wound up putting that on hold with some help, by the way, from my body, which decided to get sick with kind of a chronic fatigue thing. You know, it said, hey, wake up, you got some thinking to do. So I did some thinking and some soul searching. Decided to walk away from academia and was in the process of exploring other possibilities when music kind of crept up on me.
How did it creep up on you?
Well, I went into the practice room because I literally didn't know what to do with my time. I had cleared out everything to be able to knock off my doctoral thesis. So I kind of had an empty slate, and which is a very difficult place to be when you all of a sudden don't know what you want to do. So I spent time in the practice room because I knew that whatever time I spent doing music, it was not going to be time that I would ever regret.
Do you regret all of that work that you put in to getting to the point to be in this artificial intelligence industry? Do you regret putting all that time and effort into it?
In ways, I do. I mean, I definitely do wish that I had spent more of those formative years playing music because it really has quite an impact, you know, the hours that you spend at an early age.
Well, it sounds like with artificial intelligence, you just kind of reached a point and kind of had this epiphany that you liked it, but you didn't love it. Could you ever see that happening with a saxophone?
Interesting. Interesting question. I don't really ever see myself stopping the saxophone, but I'm not one of the people who will give you an answer that my life begins and ends with the saxophone and with jazz. It's just an expression of humanity. I feel extremely privileged to grow up in a country, in a city, and with a background where, you know, I had this notion that I ought to be able to follow my passion and that would lead to support me in some sense. You know, I just never thought of academia as a means to an income, but there turned out to be a cognitive dissonance that I was feeling that was so profound that it really, got under my skin and kind of made me sick for a while. You know, my body sort of said, hey, You don't belong here. You know, I ponder so often how many great mathematicians, jazz musicians, scientists, philosophers, doctors, poets we would have, you know, if many of the people who are just struggling to get by had the chance to really follow their dreams. And follow your dream, I mean, it sounds so rose-colored. What I mean is to work hard and to be rewarded for that and, you know, explore their passions.
Sound Effects, Kevin Kniestad with Anton Schwartz. You can hear and see more of Schwartz at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Hey, you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. And next up on our music show, a story about geomorphology. For real. David Montgomery is a professor of Earth and Space Sciences, and in 2008, he won a MacArthur Fellowship. This is the one that's usually referred to as the Genius Grant. And at the time, the foundation praised him for having, quote, a scientist's rigor, a historian's curiosity, and an environmentalist's passion. But they left something out. The soul of a blues man. When did you start playing music, David?
About when I was 16. I think I bought a bass guitar when I was 16. Although, technically, I started, I think, in fourth grade when I took up the trumpet and was advised to quit because I had no musical talent. But I started playing bass at 16 and been playing in bands most of the time on, sometimes off, like when I was getting tenure, in between.
I was going to say, did you play throughout your dissertation?
Oh, yeah. That's what kept me sane.
Why did you call your band Big Dirt?
It was called Big Dirt for a couple reasons. The one we like to advertise is that Big Dirt is kind of shorthand for planet Earth. And, you know, I'm a geologist. It kind of fits. We're kind of an environmentally themed band at some levels, although we kind of hit on all kinds of subjects. The real story behind it is that the way you name a band usually is when you start a new band, you sort of go around the table, hey, who's got a band idea name? You throw ideas out, and then everybody vetoes everything. There's a couple left. When we did that, Big Dirt was the last one on the table. Nobody vetoed it, and it had been the name of a computer in my lab.
Oh.
Yes. So there's sort of the official story, and then there's the backstory.
All right. Well, behind the music. So when did you know you were a dirt man?
when I was a kid, I just was fascinated by topography. Loved maps, would look at maps of like real places, maps of, you know, fantasy worlds, sort of maps of things, spatial arrangements of the things. Greatly interested me.
What kind of fantasy maps are we talking about?
Oh, you know, like the maps in some editions of Tolkien when I read that when I was a teenager. You know, I loved the words, but I also like loved the maps. And I feel very fortunate to have been able to make a career out of studying topography and terrain, and it's beautiful stuff. And when you go out there and you start digging into it, you know, it's covered with dirt. And it turns out that soil, the stuff on top of rocks, unlike what I learned as a geologist as an undergrad, it's that stuff on top that actually helps shape landscapes. It makes a huge difference whether or not there's a covering of dirt on the land. And it makes a huge difference, obviously, for agriculture, what kind of quality it is. And that makes a huge difference what kind of societies develop in different places. And the more you sort of look into and think about how landscapes work and how the ecology folds on top of it and then human societies and civilizations work on top of that, you realize that the soil, the life of the dirt, is really essential to all the kind of things we care about.
So with the point of view that you have on dirt, the complex processes that go into making it what it is, when you're out in the field on a mountaintop or a hillside or slogging through the muck and you're knee-deep in the dirt, how does that feel to you?
Well, it's great. I'm not in my office. you know, I'm just amazed that I can make a living where I can go out and go get to some very remote places and get absolutely filthy and look at what's happening below ground, above ground, how they're interconnected. If it's sort of very rich, fertile, earthy soil, I mean, it smells really like life itself, and it's a very invigorating and thrilling kind of perception and emotion. But if you're knee-deep in semi-boiling quicksand, it's a whole different deal. And, you know, I've had both experiences, and I prefer one a lot more to the other.
Do you feel like the science and the music exist in completely separate compartments in you, or do they cross over sometimes?
They cross-pollinate in the sense of creativity. I think it's really important in trying to foster creativity to be able to sort of let go and not think in a highly focused manner about things all the time.
A lot of people don't necessarily think of science as a creative endeavor. They think of science as the application of certain rules and being very analytical and structured. How do you think of it as a creative thing?
Oh boy, you know, you could say the same thing about music in a sense, where there's a the structure of scales and knowing the sort of rules behind the creativity, behind the process of generating something either fun, utilitarian, or beautiful, are kind of similar in those two areas, in the sense that you can view sort of statistics and mathematics and models in science kind of the way sort of learning your scales is in music. It's important to essentially the process of sort of getting something that works. But it's not necessarily related to the creative part of it. And in science, it's the questions you ask, the problems you work on.
Can you think of an example of a question that you generated or a relationship that you kind of divined in your scientific work that was a creative act that took a little bit of a leap of creativity to come up with?
Well, you know, the one that comes immediately to mind is there's a project I worked on and looking at landforms on Mars. There's a landform, a feature there that turns out to be a giant landslide, at least that's what we think it is, for which the deepest valley in the solar system, Valles Marineris, that giant trench on Mars that has inspired a lot of thinking about Mars and that there are Martian outburst floods. Well, it turns out this landslide is so big that that's a small tear on the shoulder of it. Thinking of that in a different way, it hadn't been thought of that way when we started looking at it. And we sort of looked at it, stood back, and thought, well, other than the size of this thing, which is outrageously big, what's it look like? How do we think it actually works? And we came to the idea that it was a giant landslide and followed it up. And we're pretty convinced that that is, in effect, what it is. That was an act of creativity in the sense of seeing something in a way that it really hadn't been looked at before or recognized as such. We think it's this. And that's kind of like one of those moments when you're playing music with people, with musicians you've played with before, when you hit it and it's on and you get a run of a few minutes of improvisation where it's just like, that was good. Did we record it?
Please tell me the tape was rolling.
Exactly.
Well, I could sing you songs or I could tell you stories. Could shout all night into the wind. But you and I, we both know it wouldn't change a thing in this world.
Well, David Montgomery is a geomorphologist, a professor at the University of Washington. He's also a MacArthur Fellow and the lead guitarist and songwriter for the band Big Dirt. Thanks so much for being on Sound Effect, David.
Great, thank you.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, it's Sound Effect on KPLU, and our last performance from the Sound Effect musical vault feels just about right for this time of year, weird outlying stretches of sunshine notwithstanding. In the fall and the winter, a lot of us in the Pacific Northwest are daydreaming about getting the heck out of this part of the country. But we met somebody earlier this year who was contemplating the reverse of that. So Sound Effect's Kevin Canista dropped by to explain.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, isn't it? I mean, this time of year, we're especially wanting to get to a place like Hawaii. And I talked to Amanda Frazier, who's a singer-songwriter from Hawaii. And her latest album, called Just Dream, won the Nahoku Hano Hano Award for Best Alternative Album for 2014, basically the equivalent of the Grammy Award. And on her album, she has a song called Seattle Rain, in which she sings about wishing she could trade places with the Seattle rain. And I asked her what her inspiration was for this song, and here's what she had to say.
So I actually wrote this song a couple of years ago. I was dating someone that was from Hawaii but was going to school in Seattle. And so it was a long-distance relationship, and knowing that it rains all the time in Seattle, you know, I wrote this song because I missed him. You know, he moved away, and I wasn't able to see him, but the rain got to see him every day, you know, as it was falling. And so I wrote the song to the rain. I'm singing to the rain in the lyrics.
So is it almost a jealousy of the rain?
Yeah, exactly. It's like I'm jealous of the rain because the rain gets to see him all the time, you know, gets to be near him, gets to touch him, gets to see him, spend time with him in a sense. So it was like a personification, you know, of the rain.
Would your boyfriend, would he complain about the rain while he was over here?
You know what? He loved it there. I think he still lives there now. We're not dating anymore, but he loved it, actually, the weather, the cold weather, and he didn't mind the rain at all.
So did that make it easier or harder that he liked the rain?
Harder. I'm like, no, come back to Hawaii.
So your song Seattle Rain, it's become quite popular among your fans, hasn't it? Especially in Hawaii. What do you hear from your listeners and your fans about that song?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, even though maybe not everyone's been to Seattle or can relate in that specific way, but I think it's people relate to the idea of someone being far away, you know, and wanting to be with them. And there's a lot of military presence here in Hawaii as well. And that feeling of someone's far away and you just wish it could be there. And it's a fun way of putting that into words.
And you brought your guitar with you today. Would you mind playing Seattle Rain for us now?
Yeah, I would love to.
I'll be missing him.
go and pack my bags and catch tomorrow's flight. You can't have him all to yourself, you know. No, that just isn't right. After all, sweet rain, all you do is keep him cold all through the night. Oh, see,
Amanda Fraser, winner of the 2014 Nahoku Hano Hano Award for Best Alternative Album of the Year. It's the equivalent of the Grammy Awards in Hawaii. She's singing Seattle Rain from her album Just Dream, and she talked with KPLU's Kevin Kniestad. Sound effect comes to you from senior producer Arwin Nix, and whatever the public radio equivalent of the Nahoku Hano Hano Award is, I hereby bestow it upon producer Kevin Kniestad. We had contributions this week from KPLU's Ed Ronco. John Kessler engineered The Rejections and Anton Schwartz. Our interns are Warren Langford and Casey Hicks. We get web help from Dave Nogueras, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. So are you wondering what's in this show's future? Us too, but we will do our best to keep you posted on our Facebook page. You can also connect with us on Twitter at KPLU or at Gabriel Spitzer, and email us soundeffect@kplu.org. Our free podcast is on iTunes. Subscribe and please rate and review the show while you're there. And to close out our music show, we would like to send a special shout out to Juan Perez. He is the ever-present piano player at the Nordstrom in Tacoma. And he's going through a tough time, but we want him to know we appreciate him. You can learn more about Juan's situation at kplusoundeffect.org. We're back next week with an all-new show with the unintentionally ironic theme, Unplugged.
He knew the significance of the song. He's essentially tackling one of the most legendary songs in the entire history of American music. And the, you know, a Smithsonian folkways track. And you've got a punk band from Olympia in Aberdeen jumping into this takes an incredible amount of cojones, if I can say on the radio, to dare tackle that. This is crazy in some ways.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.
What I like about you. You keep me warm at night.